Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Esther, chapter 8. In this chapter, we will see Esther saving the Jews as Mordecai issues an edict allowing the Jews to fight back on Adar 13 in response to Xerxes' previous edict instigated by Haman that said the Jews were to be massacred on Adar the 13th. And of course, Esther pulled all this off by having a banquet with Xerxes and exposing herself as a Jewish person, the queen about to get massacred because of Haman's edict, and therefore Xerxes got upset and said, hang Haman on his own gallows. So all of that was in the previous chapter. And we start now in Esther 8, verses 1 and 2. On that day, King Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes, gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Verse 1 says, on that day, what day is that? Well, that's the day of Esther's second banquet, at which she exposed Haman for the genocidalist that he was. And of course, Haman was arrested and executed on that day, hung on his own gallows. Well, the good news is, just keeps on coming on this day of Esther's second banquet, because King Xerxes gave the house of Haman to Queen Esther. The NIV says the estate of Haman. In other words, his money. Esther just made a lot of money by this because Haman had been very wealthy. We read in Esther 3:9, this is Haman speaking, if it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they, the Jews, be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. Haman is seeking to overcome any possible objections from Xerxes that Xerxes might say, if I kill all those Jews, I'll lose all the tax money. And Haman says, I got money. 10,000 talents will be paid right to you if you'll let me kill the Jews. So he has a lot of money. We also read in Esther 5:11, then Haman recounted to them, this is his wife Zeresh and Haman's friends at his house, the glory of his riches. This is after Mordecai refused to bow down to him. So Haman recounted the glory of his riches. So he had a lot of money. So in verse 1, Mordecai comes before the king. He's now introduced at court, and he's appointed one of the seven main counsels. Most probably remember there were seven eunuchs in chapter 1 that were around Xerxes giving him advice, and Mordecai is probably one of those top seven now. 4, because Esther had disclosed what he was to her. So Esther says, I'm Jewish, and Mordecai, your advisor that you had forgotten to honor, but now you did honor him by allowing or forcing Haman to walk him around in the city square with a crown, gold crown, and royal robes. That's my first cousin, or maybe second cousin. That's my cousin. And in fact, that's my adopted father. Well, Xerxes says, wow, okay. If that's so, in verse 2, the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, before Haman was executed, of course, and gave it to Mordecai. Now, a signet ring meant that you could issue edicts in the name of the king and stamp the signet ring's seal on the edict, and it had the same authority as if the king had issued the decree. And so then, Mordecai is now not only one of the seven top officials, he's the top official. He's the prime minister now instead of Haman, a total reversal of fortune. And also, Mordecai is the steward now over the house of Haman. She runs it now. She owns all of Haman's stuff, and she needs somebody to manage it, so she lets her uncle manage it, her adopted father. How do we know that Esther is Mordecai's cousin? We read in Esther 2:7, he, that's Mordecai, was bringing up Hadassah, that's Esther's Hebrew name, that is Esther, the Persian name. Mordecai was bringing up Esther, his uncle's daughter. Well, your uncle's daughter is your cousin, for she had no father or mother. So she was his cousin. Also, he was bringing her up, so that shows that he adopted her also. Now, Esther, at this juncture here, on the day that Haman is hanged, she picked a very good time to let the king know that Mordecai was her cousin, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. It was a good time. Why? Well, Xerxes knew that he had still not fully rewarded Mordecai, not for what he had done. Remember, Mordecai had foiled an assassination plot against Xerxes, a plot of two gentlemen named Bigthan and Teresh. We read that in Esther 2:21 and 22. In those days, While Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the entrance, became angry and planned to kill King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about it and informed Queen Esther. Then Esther told the king on behalf of Mordecai. And that was just 2 nights ago that Xerxes was searching through the government records and found out that Mordecai, or was reminded that Mordecai had delivered him from this assassination plot. And he starts thinking, well, how has Mordecai been honored? I don't remember anything about that. And so he calls Haman in and says, how should I honor somebody that I want to honor? And Haman ironically says, put him on a horse. And either the horse has a crown on it, a golden crown. Put royal robes on the man and let him walk around in the city square in royal robes too, to show that he's honored by the king. And so that had already been done. Haman had done that. And of course, he was mortified by that. So Xerxes has already honored Mordecai, but he hasn't really made him a big counselor, hasn't given him a lot of money yet. So this was a good time for Esther to say, hey, he's my cousin. He's my daddy. Also, at this moment, Xerxes knew this is the day of the second banquet after Haman had been exposed. Xerxes knew that Mordecai had saved his queen's life from that ill-conceived edict that Haman sent out for all the Jews to be killed on Adar 13. And then when Xerxes found out that Esther was Jewish, he realized, ooh, that means Haman has just, and I have too, because Xerxes approved of the plan, I've just passed a death sentence on my own queen. And so this is a good time to tell Xerxes, hey, this is what's happened, so that Xerxes would be in a good mood to recompense Mordecai for what had happened and to recompense Esther too. Now, Mordecai had saved his queen's life by getting Haman exposed through Esther. Now, perhaps Xerxes could have saved Esther's life. I'm sure he could have just passed another decree. Says, anybody come after Esther, that's fine according to Haman's decree. But my decree says, if anybody comes after her, you're going to get stabbed. You're going to get killed. So he could have saved her life. But it would have been embarrassing. You know, you have to do all that because of a dumb edict that he had issued in Haman's name. Or Haman had issued in his name. He would have to get around that irrevocable Persian decree of Haman somehow, and that was a lot of trouble. So Xerxes right now feels like he is in the debt of his queen Esther. Also, Esther's adopted father, Mordecai, saved him from assassination. And now Esther has saved him from having his queen assassinated. And so Xerxes responds, gives the signet ring to Mordecai. As Gil said, that was a token of the strongest affection and strictest friendship. Now Mordecai has the right to execute commands in the king's name. And a signet ring means, by the way, there's a seal. Signet means seal. There's a seal in the ring, and that seal seals the documents that says this is the word of the king. We go now to Esther 8, verses 3 and 4. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king. Now, Haman here is referred to as an Agagite. That's referring to Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites. That was the dynasty name, like Pharaoh's the king of Egypt. They were all named Pharaoh. Well, all the kings of the Amalekites were named Agag. And of course, the Amalekites were the perennial, proverbial enemies of Israel, and God had promised to wipe them out. And so this destruction of Haman is just the tail end of that promise by God to exterminate the Amalekites because of their horrible attitude towards God and toward God's chosen people. Now, Haman's dead now. This is the day of the second banquet. Haman's been executed on that day. Haman's dead, but his unrepealable edict still existed, and Esther knew it existed, and she knew she still had some further persuasion to do with Xerxes. The Jews were still in danger. So she fell at his feet. This is probably later, after the banquet, after the signet ring given, after the execution of Haman. She probably went back to his throne room, fell at his feet, wept and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman. Now, it says in verse 4 that the king extended the golden scepter. That's the golden scepter that if one came into the presence of the king uninvited, being therefore subject to capital punishment, the king had to forgive the entering person by extending his golden scepter, and then the supplicant touched the golden scepter to show that he or she had accepted the forgiveness of the king. Now, the golden scepter needed to be extended for maybe one of two reasons. again, maybe to show that Esther was again entering Xerxes' presence unbidden, as John Gill says, after the second banquet was over, Haman executed, and so forth. She had come back to Xerxes. That makes sense to me. The NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the golden scepter was extended to Esther to show that Xerxes was favorably disposed to stopping Haman's edict. Probably both, really. So Esther arises and stands before the king in verse 4. The reason she arose is because in verse 3, she was on the floor. She fell at his feet, crying. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that when she did this, Xerxes was probably reclining on a sofa because it was the usual Persian custom to lean back with one foot under the body and one on the ground. So we can picture the scene most probably as Esther face plants before Xerxes. We go now to Esther 8, 5 through 8. Then Esther said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged, Haman, they have hanged on the gallows because Haman had stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now you write to the Jews as you see fit, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." Now verse 5 starts out with four ifs. "If it pleases the king," Esther says, "and if I, Esther, have found favor before the king, and if the matter seems proper to the king, and if I am pleasing in his sight," those four repeated conditions show Esther's extreme submissiveness to the king, as John Gill says. She's trying to work up his affection. Of course, she's very, very modest and deferential to the king. After all, he's a Eastern Oriental despot. Now, these conditions are conditionals which Esther knows are going to be answered in the affirmative. If it pleases the king, she knows she pleases the king. If she has found favor in his sight, she knows she's found favor in his sight. And if it seems proper to the king, she knows it's proper to the king. And if I am pleasing in his sight, she knows she's pleasing in his sight. So it's almost like she's saying since it pleases the king, but that would be too forward, too presumptuous. Plus, the language doesn't really mean that. You can't translate it as since, it's if. But it's ifs that Esther is pretty sure are going to be answered in Xerxes' minds by yeses. So if all those conditions are met, and they will, and they are, Xerxes, you know they are, Esther's thinking, give me some letters to counteract the edict devised by Haman. Now, notice that she says devised by Haman. She doesn't say devised by Haman and you, Xerxes, because that was the truth. That's what actually happened, because Xerxes had given his approval to this edict to murder the Jews. But Esther cleverly takes no notice that Xerxes had agreed with Haman's issuing of the edict. Esther made it look like she thought that Haman had forged the decree in the king's name. Oh, that's smart politics. Esther is not only a beautiful woman, she's a very smart woman, a very diplomatic woman. After all, she managed to become queen of Persia. So Xerxes responds favorably, write to the Jews. However you want to tell the Jews to defend themselves, that's fine with me. And remember, a decree written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked. And of course, he's given the signet ring to Haman, so he just repeats that. Remember now, the law is irrevocable. So, and he's probably saying this to say, look, I would just counteract Haman's edict, but I can't, because the law is, Persian laws are irrevocable. Once they're issued, they cannot be repealed, which in my humble opinion is a dumb way to do things, but that's the way they did it back then. Now, there was an old Persian law that made Persian laws irrevocable, but there was no law that said a law couldn't be superseded by another law. And so that's what Xerxes is doing here. He's just superseding Haman's law with Mordecai's law. He doesn't tell them, Mordecai and Esther, how to write such a repealing law, but he says, you do it. You can do it. We know the laws of the Medes and Persians cannot be revoked. That's also mentioned in Daniel 6:12. Then they approached and spoke before the king. It's disputed who this king was. It says Darius in the text. They approached and spoke before Darius about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The they that's approaching the king are the king's officials. The king replied, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Now, Xerxes mentioned that the law of the Medes and Persians could not be revoked because he wants to give a reason to Esther. I can't revoke the law, but you could make another law. So we go now to verses 9 through 11 in Esther 8. And by the way, this is a totally irrelevant factoid. Esther 8:9 is the longest verse in the Bible, in almost every English translation, at least in the ESV, and I think others too. My wife is an ex-fundamentalist. She was raised as a fundamentalist, and in fundamentalist churches such as hers, they're taught things like this. They don't bring you one centimeter closer to God or to Jesus, but it's interesting. It's irrelevant, but interesting. True, but trivial. So we read now in Esther 8, 9 through 11. So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the province. Those are just the Persian officials. The provinces which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. Remember, script is not the same thing as the language. For example, French and German use the same script that English people use, but their languages are totally different. Script is what you write the spoken language down with. But just to make sure everything's covered, every script, every language is covered, this is to make sure that all the Jews knew they have a right to defend themselves. Verse 10, Esther 8, he, that's Mordecai, he's using scribes here, but Mordecai wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. I like that little detail. Fast horses, got to get the word out. Now, they had about 8 months or so. I can't do the math real quick in my head, but it was a long time before Adar 13. It's just now Sivan 13. Sivan's the third month. Adar the 13th, when the massacre was going to take place, is the 12th month. So you're talking about eight months or so. So I don't know why they were in such a hurry to get out there, but they did. Verse 11, in them, in the letters, the edict, in other words, in them the king granted the Jews who were in each city and in every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. Now, it could be that the message was sent so quickly by Mordecai out to the provinces is because the Jews needed time to defend themselves. I mean, it's one thing to say you can defend yourself, but you got to get your fortifications ready. You got to get your weapons ready. You got to train people militarily. That's probably why he was in such a hurry to get the relieving edict out. Now, Mordecai's edict was sent out in Sivan on the 23rd day. That is 2 months and 10 days after Haman's edict had been issued. Now, what I'm going to do here is I am going to give you a summary of key dates in the 12th year of Xerxes, just to keep straight in our head. We're going to use the months of the Hebrew religious calendar, not the secular calendar. Starting in Nisan, the first month of the year, and the year is Xerxes' 12th year. He started ruling in 486 B.C., Nisan was the first month, the day's not mentioned, but that's the day that the lots were cast to find a propitious day to massacre the Jews. Haman was responsible for that. We read that in Esther 3:7. In the first month, the month of Nisan, in King Ahasuerus' 12th year, no day is mentioned, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman for each day in each month, and it fell on the 12th month, the month Adar. So the casting of lots was done in Nisan the first month, and the day for killing the Jews was decided by those lots on the 12th month, Adar. Or that was Nisan, somewhere at the first of Nisan. Then Nisan 13, shortly thereafter, Haman's edict against the Jews was promulgated. Esther 3:12, the royal scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. That's Nisan's the first month, 13th day, and the order was written exactly as Haman commanded. So the edict goes out to the provinces on Nisan the 13th. Now, here we are in Sivan 23rd, which is the third month, May or June. Nisan is March or April. Sivan is May or June. And I'm going to call this Mordecai and Esther's retaliatory edict to let the Jews fight back, which we just read about. That was the third month. And, of course, Adar 13th is the 12th month. That's the day chosen by the lots, cast in the first part of Nisan in the first month of the year. The lots were cast for the massacre of Jews. Adar 13th was chosen. And of course, that's going to be the same day that the Jews can fight back. Now, in Mordecai and Esther's retaliatory decree of Sivan 23, we see that the king, Xerxes, had granted the Jews, who were in each and every city, the right to assemble and to defend their lives. That's military defense. Before Mordecai's decree, Haman's decree would result in this sad situation. A Jew attempting self-defense on Adar the 13th would be liable to murder charges. But now, with Mordecai's decree, a Jew can defend himself. Now, Mordecai's decree said that any Jew could find his enemies and destroy, kill, and annihilate them in verse 11. Those are the exact same words that were in Haman's decree. Esther 3:13. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. I'm using the NASB translation. The three words are exactly the same. In fact, those three words are the exact same words Esther used to accuse Haman at Esther's second banquet, Esther 7:4, as Esther speaks to King Xerxes. We have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, some have objected. Why would Xerxes allow a civil war in his kingdom? This objection was brought up by Barnes, quoting some other skeptical types. Well, here's the answer. Xerxes cannot stop the massacre he's already ordered against the Jews. Now, he might have made a mistake in doing that, and I'm sure he realizes he did because he was misled by Haman, but he had no choice. He has to give the Jews the right to fight back. Otherwise, the Jews are going to get massacred, so that's why he put up with a civil war in his kingdom. Barnes also makes the point that even the most skeptical critics will allow, that's not unreasonable for Xerxes or improbable that Xerxes allowed this civil war. It wasn't much of a civil war. It was over in a day. Now, verse 11 says that Mordecai and Esther's decree said that the Jews could kill the children and women of their opponents. Now, it's doubtful that the Jews exercised this right to kill their enemies' women and children because the Jews spared their enemies their spoil. They didn't plunder their enemies. We read that in Esther 9:10, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Jews' enemy, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Well, if they spared the spoil, they most likely spared the women and children too, as Benson and Poole say. And I speculate that Esther and Mordecai probably knew the Jews wouldn't actually do this. Well, then why would Mordecai and Esther write such a decree that had that provision in it? Well, they wanted to give the Jews the same power as Haman's edict. It was customary to destroy the families of people guilty of great crimes. And they say, okay, Haman, you want to put this kind of decree against the Jews? We're going to put one against you too. And Benson points out that this would strike greater terror into the Jews' enemies, knowing that their whole families would be wiped out. So that means that the Jews' enemies are likely to leave them alone. So now the Jews have about 9 months to prepare their defense from roughly Sivan 23 and Adar 13, 3rd month to 12th month, about 9 months, maybe a little less. They're getting ready. One little detail before we leave this section of scriptures. The horses that sent out the message, the King James translates it as the word as mules, camels, and young dromedaries. Ay, ay, ay. A mule going from Susa to India and Susa to Ethiopia? I don't think so. Another example of a bad translation. The NIV has horses especially bred for the king, which I think is probably correct. Adam Clark says that the Hebrew word translated mule in the KJV signifies a swift chariot horse. A swift chariot horse, folks, ain't a mule. This is what Clark further says. There is really so much confusion about these matters and so little consent among learned men as to the signification of these words, and even the true knowledge of them is of such little importance, that we may well rest contented with such names as our modern translations have given us. They were, these mules, these horses, were no doubt the swiftest and hardiest beast that the city or country could produce. Not a mule, folks, it was a horse. One other minor point I mentioned about the scripts being different in all the provinces. Here's some examples of different scripts used in the Persian Empire. This is from John Gill. There was a script for the Persian language. There's a different script for the Chaldee or the Babylonian language. There was a different script for the Syriac language and a different script for the Hebrew language. Now, I'm not an expert on ancient Near Eastern languages. I'm assuming Gill is right. If he's wrong, you can go complain to him, except he's dead. All right, so we now go to Esther 8:12 through 14. I broke this right in the middle of a verse, which I shouldn't have done, so let me go back and get the beginning of the sentence that verse 12 finishes up. The letters of Mordecai, the king granted the Jews to dot, 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 to plunder their spoil, verse 12, on one day, and all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. In other words, the edict says on one day, you can do all this. You can kill, destroy, and annihilate your enemies and take their spoil. That one day in verse 12 is stated to be the 13th day of the 12th month. That is the month Adar. Of course, that's the day that the lot had chosen for the massacre of the Jews originally by Haman. Verse 13, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the peoples. This is Mordecai's edict, the retaliatory edict, so that the Jews would be ready for this day, for Adar 13, to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, hastened and impelled by the king's command, went out, riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. Of course, Susa is the capital of the Persian Empire, about 200 miles northeast of the northern tip of the Persian Gulf, right to the east of the Tigris River, where there are many, many wonderful ancient ruins still in existence there. Now, why is this seemingly superfluous fact that the decree was also promulgated in Susa added? It was obviously promulgated in all the far-flung provinces, but why Susa? Adam Clark says the reason is that this shows that the publication of Mordecai's edict was the same as Haman's edict. Because in Esther 3:15 we read this, the couriers went out impelled by the king's command while the decree, now this is Haman's decree, was issued at the citadel in Susa. And while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. So the original edict went out from the citadel, that's the military fortress there in Susa, the capital city. The original decree went out from there, and the retaliatory decree also, Mordecai's retaliatory decree went out from the citadel in Susa. I think there's a little dramatic effect there. So we read now in Esther 8:15-17, and we will finish this chapter. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, that's Mordecai's decree, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So Mordecai goes out into the city of Susa, leaving Xerxes behind. He's wearing blue and white. That's the color of Persian kings. Persian kings, in fact, were not allowed to wear any other color but blue and white. John Gill, quoting the famous Greek historian Xenophon, tells us this little detail. Clark speculates that the blue and white was perhaps striped, stripe interchanged with stripe, or it could be the robe was blue and bordered with white fur. I'm sure it looked just great. He has a crown of gold on his head and a garment of fine linen and purple. That would probably be under the robe, tunic, linen, which is white, purple and white. Wow, that's a lot of honor for a despised Jew. Now in Susa there was gladness, joy for the Jews. That says joy for the Jews. Who's shouting with joy here for the Jews? Well, of course the Jews are, but the question arises, maybe native people are shouting for joy too. John Gill says they would be shouting if the natives had any sense of humanity about them. They would have rejoiced that such an evil man as Haman was gone now, and that such a good man as Mordecai had replaced him. As Adam Clark says, Haman was too proud to be popular, and few lamented his fall. And also, this is my idea, it would seem that many of the natives probably had intermarried with the Jews. And if they had not, they probably had Jewish friends. They didn't want to see Jews getting massacred all over the place. So I suspect that everybody's pretty happy, Jews as well as native Persians. Now, a feast and a holiday was celebrated here. Doesn't say when, I'm going to assume it's on the 14th and 15th of Adar, because that's when the modern Feast of Purim is celebrated, unless the year is a leap year, in which case 2nd Adar is used. 2nd Adar 13 is the day before the Feast of Purim, which would be 14th and 15th day of 2nd Adar. Now we need to see why it's 2 days afterwards. Let's look at the scriptures here in the next chapter, Esther 9:17. They, that's the Jews, fought on the 13th day of the month of Adar, the day chosen by Haman to kill the Jews by lot, by the Purim. They fought on the 13th day of the month of Adar and rested on the 14th, and it became a day of feasting and rejoicing. So that's out in the provinces. They fought on day 13. They also fasted, I think. They feasted on day 14, but in Susa things were different, the capital city, Esther 9:18. But the Jews in Susa had assembled on the 13th and the 14th days of the month. They rested on the 15th day of the month, and it became a day of feasting and rejoicing. So they added an extra day in Susa, the capital. And so today, modern Jews celebrate Purim on the 14th and 15th of Adar. Adar, remember, is February/March. Now the end of verse 17 says this, "And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them." Now when it says they became Jews, of course that doesn't mean their genes or their ethnicity changed. It means they became proselytes. There were two kinds of proselytes, proselytes of the gate, kind of junior proselytes, and senior proselytes. The real deal is proselytes of righteousness. And in order to become a proselyte of righteousness, according to the NIV Study Bible, you had to get circumcised, you had to observe the holy days, the feasts, and the festivals, you had to observe the dietary laws. A proselyte of the gate just had to basically be moral, obey the Ten Commandments. So many of these people, I'm assuming, as proselytes of righteousness, the real deal, the real Jews. Why? For the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So that presents a problem. Why were these Persians becoming proselytes? Were they sincere proselytes? John Gill says, yes, they were. They were impressed by the incredible miracle that had saved the Jews. But there's another argument that John Gill brings up that says that, no, they weren't sincere proselytes. They were sucking up to Esther and Mordecai, who now had great influence and power. They were afraid the Jews would harm them, John Gill suggests. It actually says in verse 17, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. And, of course, it could be both. It could be they were impressed by the miracle, and also they could be afraid of Mordecai. That dread might be interpreted as fear that the Jews would kill them, as John Gill takes it, but the NIV Study Bible takes it as awed recognition that the Jews had been granted divine protection. And again, it could be both. Some people were afraid of Mordecai, some people were impressed by the Jews, who knows. But we go now from a situation where the Jews were going to be reduced in population, and now they are increased in population. Ladies and gentlemen, on that very happy note, we have now finished Esther chapter 8, and we are now ready in our next audio to go to Esther 9, verses 1 through 32, the Jews destroy their enemies and inaugurate Purim. I hope you stay tuned for that historical matter as we see where the current feast of Purim came from, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.